agus fáilte a rás to the Crazy House Prizes podcast. I'm your host, Ciarán Mulqueen, and today we have a conversation with an Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, obviously a very central figure in Ireland's housing policies over the last 12 years. I was very surprised when I got a DM on Instagram from him asking to come on to the podcast, so I figured it would be best to book a studio and get it done in person. So the audio between the studio and this one I'm recording now might not be as good. So just keep that in mind. I also want to acknowledge up front that I know many of you might be expecting or even hoping for a heated exchange here. And I get that. I totally understand the anger and the frustration that are out there. It's palpable. The fallout from the housing crisis is real and it affects us all. However, I'm not here to scream and shout at people. That's not my style, nor is it the purpose of this conversation. Instead, I've opted for an open dialogue, a chance to hear about the challenges that the government are facing, the strategies, the successes, any failures, straight from the source, the leader of the country. And importantly, I want to put forward some tangible ideas to him that might help us as a society move forward. And if you listen right to the end of the conversation, there are some good ideas that I have in my book, some of which an Taoiseach, Mr. Varadkar himself, found quite good. So I'm hoping that these ideas can help to improve the home buying process in Ireland. So make sure you listen right to the end for that part. It's kind of like the last minute of the conversation. And I guess just from running the page over the last few years, I've understood at this point now that it's far better to have respectful and productive conversations with people, especially leaders of the country. It's what I did with Dara O'Brien. And because of that, we got a good few wins after that conversation in terms of followers that got in touch with me that were being evicted or having issues with other things. And I can reach directly out to Dara and he sorted out a couple of those. And I know that's not how it should work, but I'll take any wins I can get. And if that keeps somebody in a home rather than them being evicted, I'll take it. Then we've also got the housing estate that I spoke to him about that went viral, and they stepped in and they stopped it being bought by an investment fund. Things like that, I would not have gotten them had I started attacking Dara O'Brien on the podcast or on social media. So if I had gone into this conversation with Leo Varadkar the way some people would have liked me to in the comments on my Instagram, me as a complete amateur with zero experience going up against a very experienced politician who deals with those type of people day in, day out, let me tell you, it would not have gone well for me and the conversation would not have been productive whatsoever. So I do hope you enjoy the chat with him, and please do keep in mind that I'm not Vincent Brown, I'm not a qualified journalist, I'm not an interviewer, I'm not a reporter, I'm just a guy with a phone with a few followers on Instagram, and I do my best to get some good questions across to Leo Varadkar, and we were tight for time. But please do remember, I'm not a professional interviewer, but I do think it becomes a positive, productive conversation that hopefully leads to some form of change. And I just want to put the conversation into context with a few stats, okay? So from Housing Europe, their report just came out last week and I talked to Leo Varadkar about that in the conversation. But basically, it talks about Housing for All, and the reason Housing for All comes up a lot is because they just released their report, their quarterly report, and Housing Europe had a few comments on it by saying, while Housing for All is more ambitious, even if its goals are met, by very conservative estimates, we would still have around about 170,000 fewer homes than are required by 2030. And of course, we need to look at vacant housing as well, rather than only new builds. And that's something I talked to Leo about as well in the episode. And also, the main group impacted by these supply issues are younger people. There were 251,000 25 to 34 year olds living with parents in 2021, with 153,000 of these in full-time jobs, and 94% of these people want to leave their parents' home but they can't. Something I talk about all the time. And the number of young adults at home in Ireland is way out of whack with peers like Austria and Denmark and the Netherlands. It's 41% in Ireland versus just 4% in Denmark. Now in Denmark, they put a really strong focus on youth specific housing options, so that's an important factor, which we don't do here. And then just some other stats. One that I go on about all the time is actually the lack of supply that's available to buy. So in 2022, there were 29,581 homes built, 8,200 1,419 of these were sold to owner-occupiers, 9,166 were built to rent, and only 8,590 were actually for sale. And the proportion of new homes available for sale has declined by over 43%. This is as of 2022. And 7 out of 10 new homes built in 2022 were one-off homes, or so as in self-builds or social build homes or build to rent. So only 3 out of 10 new homes are actually available for sale. And on that, first time buyer activity has increased actually 30% since 2017. But the activity on new homes is down over 70%. This is because of a lack of new housing available. So these people are forced to buy homes in commuter towns. So there's just very little in Dublin. So just before we go into the conversation, a really quick reminder that if you like what I'm doing here with the podcast and with the Instagram, please do have a look at patreon.com/crazyhouseprices. You can kind of get involved then in ongoing dialogue. There's more exclusive content over there just for patrons, like Q&A podcasts and things like that. It also, the support over there is what helps keep this podcast going, keeps the Instagram going, and just helps bring us all closer to finding solutions. So with that all said, let's dive in to the episode. I'm going to pause the podcast for a second because I want to talk to you about a company called Financial Planning Matters. Their website is fpms.ie. This is a company that I know very well, and the team behind it are fantastic. It's a small Irish company that believes that financial planning should be accessible, easy to understand, and affordable for everyone. That's why they offer personalized financial advice that's tailored to your unique needs and goals. Their team of expert financial planners will look at your current financial situation and develop a personalized strategy to give you a roadmap to achieve your financial goals. It's not just about setting up a pension or investing your money. They'll consider all aspects of your finances to help you get to where you want to be. So that could be saving for your deposit. It could be knowing where to invest your children's allowance. It could be maybe you have loads of money and you want to know what to do with it. So their customer service is incredible. I've been using them for over a year now and I cannot recommend them enough. So check out fpms.ie. Now, back to the podcast.
I guess the kind of main question I wanted to ask you was about something that, you know, impacts me, it impacts most frontline workers, impacts most people that I kind of engage with on a daily basis. And that's just how a city can function when frontline workers, nurses, teachers like myself, Gardaí, you just can't afford to live in Dublin. That's kind of the main thing I'm getting in every single day. So how, in your opinion, how does the city function going forward when so many schools are struggling to find staff, so many hospitals, the new hospital, where are their staff going to live? So,
yeah, well, look, first of all, thanks for having me on the podcast. I do follow you on Instagram, so I've found what you do very interesting and very educational as well.
Thank you.
Great to read the stories of first-time buyers getting their first home and obviously horrified by some of the examples of really sharp practice and appalling behaviour in the rental sector, which I see on the Instagram posts, which I need to hear about, because part of my job obviously is to be aware of these things and to change them. But to answer your question, like, a city can't function, quite frankly, if there isn't affordable housing for people for places to buy and people for places to rent. And the housing crisis isn't only in Dublin, it's in all parts of Ireland, but it is at its worst, of course, in Dublin. And it's not just about key workers. You know, you need people who are going to work as security guards, as taxi drivers, people working in shops, you know, people who work in cafes and restaurants, you name it. Like, they're all key workers, in my view, not just public servants. So, and if you don't have affordable housing for people, then a city can't function well. And, you know, I wouldn't like to see Dublin become one of those cities where only wealthy people can live in the city centre, and there are cities like that, and we need to make sure that doesn't happen. And that means ramping up social housing a lot, which we are doing as a government, but we need to do it more. And it means new forms of public housing that are new to Ireland but are now becoming a reality in Ireland, like cost rental, for example. So you'll have seen St. Michael's Estate, not too far away from where both of us live. Planning Commission just came through there the other day, and that's going to be a mixture of social housing and cost rental, but we need way more of that at a scale that we're not yet currently delivering.
Yeah, I saw actually Dara Turnbull, the Housing Europe, they just released their latest kind of report today. And that is one of the main things they speak about in terms of recommendations as to policies that we in Ireland can look towards, and like that cost rental, which is fantastic, in the housing for all, it's brilliant. My only criticism would be that there's just not enough. It's not ambitious enough, even going by the targets in the housing for all. Even if we did meet those goals, the Housing Europe estimate that we would have 170,000 fewer homes than we actually require by 2030. And that would be a pretty conservative estimate. So, and with the release of the kind of updates on the quarterly figures for Housing for All, how do we tackle that? As you said, we need more affordable options for people to buy as well as to rent.
Yeah, well, look, we definitely need to scale things up as quickly as we can. There's a huge deficit of housing in Dublin and in Ireland, and we need to catch up on that. You know, if I think back, I've had the privilege to be in government now for nearly 12 years. And if I think back to when we first got into government, there were only 7,000 homes being built every year. It's now 30,000. Social housing had almost ground to a halt, and we've really got that going again in the last couple of years. And things like cost rental didn't even exist. You know, it was the much maligned Owen Murphy who actually kicked that off, and now Dara's seeing that through and is making cost rental a reality. But we do need to scale it up. I'm on the record as saying I don't think the existing housing targets are ambitious enough. Dara O'Brien agrees, and we're going to revise them by the end of the year and increase the number of builds considerably, and that's housing of all types. It's social housing, it's housing for people to buy, cost rental, other forms of housing too, and that's what we have to do. But there are constraints, you know, the amount of available service land, the planning process, all those things that you know about, and we're working on them too.
But I guess with the figure, say even from last year, it was around about 30,000 homes built last year, but 7 out of 10 of those were either one-offs built for social or were rentals. So few, I think it was 8,590 were built that people could actually buy. So with so few homes available for people to buy, how is affordability ever going to come down when so many people need a home and want to buy a home? But if there's only 8,500 available for me, say, to purchase, how is that going to bring prices down?
Well, there aren't enough homes being built for people to buy. You know, I acknowledge that. I don't think it's a case, though, that we need less social housing being built or less cost rental being built. We need more housing of all forms being built, but particularly as the total quantum of houses being built every year increases, we need to see a greater proportion of them being homes for people to buy. About 2/3 of first-time buyers actually buy a second-hand home. They don't buy a first home, so affordability touches on the two. And then, you know, the kind of things we're trying to do to help people. I know demand-side measures are controversial, but they do help first-time buyers get a leg into the market and give them some sort of advantage over people who are trading up or trading down or maybe buying for investment purposes. And that's why we have things like the Help to Buy and First Home and the Local Authority Home Loans to help people get a mortgage if they can't get one from the banks. And then the new grants that we have for dereliction to bring out of use old residential properties, vacant derelicts, back into use. And we're seeing great uptake on that now. In Cork alone, about 500 applications have gone through.
And the Housing for All, it does show that the activity in first-time buyers has increased. It's increased by 30% or so since 2017. But the activity on those new homes in the city, in Dublin, is down over 70%. And that's just due to a lack of housing estates being built in Dublin. And that's forcing those people then to move outside of Dublin into those commuter kind of towns. And that kind of brings me back to the first question is, if those people are finally able to get out of the rental sector and buy their own home, but then it's in a commuter town, like it's going to be such atrocious public transport. How does the city just keep functioning, you know, if people aren't able to live in there? And obviously we were very lucky to be able to do it, but that's because we could move home. But we shouldn't have to move home at 36 to be able to save, to get a deposit together. Like, again, going back to the Housing Europe, they did that survey and the main group impacted by this lack of supply are 25 to 34-year-olds, of which there are 251,000 of them living with their parents in 2021, likely up since then. And 94% of them don't want to live there, obviously. I did a poll on my page of over 15,000 renters, and over 15,000 renters responded, and 96% of them said they're not renting by choice. And I know Threshold did a recent one and it was about 85% thereabouts. I would argue probably because rent prices are extortionate. They're the highest they've ever been. So that's obviously why they don't want to be paying $3,000 on a home that their mortgage would probably only be 1,000. So my question is, like, how do we approach all of that? And considering that you've been in government for 13 years now, 12 years?
Not quite, but approaching it.
Yeah. So how do you, I guess, as the leader of the party, how do you back up those figures and the work that's being done? Because I know the Housing for All thing is, it's saying that it's measuring progress, but how is that progress measured? Because to me, it feels like they're measuring the progress by saying we're putting more money into this, but house prices are going up, rents are going up, homeless figures are going up. How are you measuring the progress there?
Yeah, well, look, just at the outset, you know, I totally get the fact that there are a lot of people who are forced to live at home with their parents for much longer than anyone would want to be. When I was in my 20s, which had been back in the 1990s, it was normal enough for people who were 23 or 24 to buy their first home. That's pretty rare now. I think the average person in Ireland now leaves home around 28. Now, I know very few people are average, but, you know, roughly speaking, people are living at home for 5 years longer than they used to. And I get that. And when I'm knocking on doors as a politician, you know, it's very often the 20-something who comes to the door, but it's, or the 30-something comes to the door, but it's not their house, it's their parents' house. And then I'd often talk to people as well in their, you know, 60s and 70s who are angry at the fact that their adult kids can't get a home. Yeah. And, you know, I get that. I see that every day. And, like, the main thing we can do is to try and ramp up the supply of new homes. And that is what we're doing. Not happening quickly enough, I get that. And we're making up for what is a really big deficit for a long period after the financial crash where very few homes were built. And we're making up for that deficit now. And it's not happening quickly enough. But we are doing everything we can to speed it up, whether it's servicing new land, reforming the planning laws so things get through planning quicker, and if they end up being judicially reviewed, at least a decision gets made quicker, and then all the different ways that we're helping people to become first-time buyers.
Hi, I am just going to pause the podcast for a second to talk to you about some sponsors of the Crazy House Prices podcast. This episode is sponsored by Daft.ie. Daft is Ireland's number one property portal. Daft has the most properties available for sale and rent and is the preferred national property website amongst consumers in Ireland. So Daft.ie's core vision is to make buying, selling and renting property better for everyone in Ireland. So Daft's mission is to simplify each step of every property transaction in the Irish market to make buying, selling and renting in Ireland simple. That's why Daft.ie build innovative tools like Offers by Daft, an online real-time offers platform that provides never-before-seen transparency for the Irish consumer when buying a home. Are you looking to buy? Maximise your chances of finding your dream home by visiting Daft.ie, Ireland's number one property website.
And the big thing, obviously, that is impacting, I think, your government polls, probably what you're seeing on the doorsteps as well, is the homeless figures. And I'm sure it's something that you're answering questions on every day, all day, every day. And Dara O'Brien the same. But I asked him this question, so I'll ask it to you. How, when you hear those figures, 12,500 and 4,000 children mainly being homeless, like, how does that make you feel?
Well, pretty bad. Like, how could you possibly not feel awful about that? And, you know, people in Ireland find homelessness to be offensive. The fact that people have to be homeless or are forced into homelessness is offensive, and I find that too. The reasons for homelessness are complex. There are lots of different reasons why people are homeless, and there are lots of different types of homelessness. So I think that does need to be acknowledged. But it's something that I find very difficult and feel distressed for the people who are affected. That's why we try to do so much, particularly to lift people out of homelessness and to prevent people from becoming homeless all the time. So it's right to say that there are more people in emergency accommodation now than we've ever had before, over 12,000. But we've also reached record numbers of getting people out of homelessness and preventing homelessness. So, you know, from the Housing for All progress report just out there the other day, 1,500 families were prevented, or people were prevented from becoming homeless or lifted out of homelessness in the last quarter. That's the highest too. But the numbers coming in are exceeding the numbers that we can get out.
And they're the official numbers. Yeah. Like, the stories I get in are just incredibly depressing, and it's all day, every day. And even one of a family I know, and it's a 6-year-old, and the parents both full-time jobs, both well paid, paid more than me, and they got evicted like thousands of others have been, the landlord selling the house or whatever, and they had to, their family basically were torn apart. The dad had to move down to Wexford to his parents, and the mom and the child then are staying in a on a couch in a friend's house, just to be, so she could still go to school. Like, they're not part of that 12,500 figure, and the 250,000 25 to 34 year olds living at home. There's just hundreds of thousands of hidden homeless that aren't in those figures. And as you said, you're getting more people out of homelessness or avoiding homelessness, but that's going back to the whole complete unaffordability of the country and where prices have gone, not just for house prices, but for rent and everything, energy bills, childcare prices. Everything is just spiraling out of control, and people are really, really struggling. And that's what I'm seeing every day.
Yeah. And look, I people are struggling with the cost of living and the housing crisis. I see it every day too. In fairness, now childcare is one of the areas where costs are actually coming down. You know, because of the decisions we were able to make in the last budget, we were able to reduce the cost of childcare by 25%.
Yeah, but when your rent is tripled and quadrupled, you know, that's not much help.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, I don't think everyone's rent has tripled or quadrupled, but I know for a lot of people it has gone up. What have we done about that? You know, the rent tax credit, which I think is some help to people. Mm. It's 500 euros for a single person, 1,000 for a couple, 1,500 if there's three renting. I think that is a bit of help. And the rent pressure zones, you know, mean that for the vast majority of people who are renting are actually covered by the rent pressure zones. Mm. And the maximum increase allowed there is 2%. And we can see from the census the difference between the average rent that people actually pay and those kind of asking figures that you see in daft.ie, for example. And that does show that a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people, have been protected from those rent increases.
Unless they get like that. I don't know if you saw the story. I was actually talking to Dara O'Brien about this yesterday, and he's looking into it. But there was a family who were evicted. Landlord said he was selling the house, as they always do. Mm. Didn't sell the house, put it back up for rent. They were renting for 1,700, put it back up for 3,750, which is obviously illegal. And Dara O'Brien's looking into that. But that's not the only case of that. This is happening nonstop. And the frustrations I get from people all the time are, it feels like, and I know it's not the case, but it feels like there is a complete lack of regulation on these landlords that are acting rogue and giving the other genuine good landlords a bad name. Same goes for estate agents. It's always a minority, you know, that give the whole profession or the whole cohort a bad name. And what are you doing to try and amend that, to try and fix that, to make landlords a bit more accountable to the RTB? Because at the moment it feels like it's a bit toothless.
I think there is a lack of enforcement. I did see that case, and obviously I can't comment in individual cases, but if it is what it appears to be, it was a blatant breach of the law. You know, you can't serve a notice to quit on somebody based on a false premise. And if that's what happened, that was against the law. And there is an enforcement section in the RTB. And what we've been trying to do over the last couple of years is to kind of beef up that agency, improve its staffing, improve its IT so that it can do enforcement better. And I think people need to see prosecutions happen, and they need to hear of court cases where rogue landlords get convicted, get fined. And that has a demonstration effect, will make other landlords think twice about behaving in that way, and also will give people the reassurance that laws are being enforced. I do get complaints about the RTB, though, in both directions. You know, you get it from small landlords as well. Yeah. And, you know, landlords aren't the enemy. For as long as we need places to rent, we're going to need landlords. And they would be very critical of the RTB as well.
Yeah.
That if they have a tenant who, you know, hasn't paid the rent for years, has been engaging in antisocial behaviour, they find it very hard to get a rapid determination from the RTB too.
I see both sides of it as well. I guess it's a bit like being a politician. You're not going to please everyone. Same with the RTB. They do get it from both sides as well. But I guess it's trying
But it is an agency that isn't functioning the way it should. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Some of it's staffing, some of it's IT. And the criticisms are coming from both sides. But it is a bit like on board Panala, which isn't working as it should for lots of different reasons. Like, it is something we are genuinely working on. We're putting the additional money in. Not find it so easy to find the qualified staff, but I think that will get better.
And that's an issue, I think, in every sector, is finding staff or staff, finding staff that have somewhere to live. And obviously, I don't want to keep banging the teacher drum, but it is also impacting large companies, multinationals, finding somewhere for their staff to live. And it's having a devastating impact. Yeah. But I guess going back to...
That isn't just about housing, though. Housing is part of it. You know, we do also full employment.
Yeah, totally.
And,
you
know, there's no sector of the economy now where people aren't struggling to find staff. Private, public, small businesses, big businesses, well-paid jobs, not so well-paid jobs. And it is one of the unintended consequences, I suppose, of having full employment, that recruitment and retention is a real challenge. But I'd rather have that challenge than what we had before, which was, you know, double-digit unemployment and youth unemployment and people having to emigrate as a result. And it's not that long ago that that's where we were.
Yeah. Another thing that, you know, people speak to me about very, very often is the massive number of vacant houses and homes and habitable homes, not just, and not including holiday homes. The census, it was over 160,000. And I know the vacant and derelict tax has come in. In my opinion, it's very low. It's probably not enough of a stick to encourage somebody who is sitting on a vacant or a derelict house to do something about it, because it's so low. I think it's a little bit more than what their property tax will be. Would you ever consider making that a bit more of a radical tax, a bit higher?
Yeah, we would. It's a new tax. It's set, if I remember correctly, it's 3 times your LPT.
Yeah.
You know, it is designed to force, stroke, encourage people not to leave properties vacant for too long, which is unacceptable in a housing crisis, that people would leave properties vacant for 6 months, a year on end. So it is a new tax. And what we wanted to do was introduce it, collect the data and see how it goes. So it is open to us in the budget to increase that. And that's something that is under consideration. We're trying to use a carrot and stick approach. So on the one hand, there's the tax for leaving home vacant, but there's also all the grants as well to renovate an old building and bring it back into use for housing, which is working well. And just in the last couple of days, we announced this fund for local authorities. They have 150 million now that they can use to buy properties, renovate them for residential, sell them on, and then use that money again to buy another vacant building. One thing that will be useful, and we'll have this kind of data soon, is we'll have a better sense to how many habitable homes really are vacant and where they are, because that census figure is right, 160,000. But we did drill down into that, and there are reasons why homes are vacant. You know, sometimes they're for sale, sometimes they're for renovation, sometimes the person in the house is in hospital or a nursing home, maybe not even for a long period of time. Sometimes they're in probate, you know what I mean, because the person in it has died. So there's actually a lot of reasons why a home may be vacant. Certainly in our cities, our vacancy rates would be comparable with other cities. There are higher levels of vacancies in rural areas for sure.
And I guess that's, even if of that 160,000, if we manage to get even a quarter of those, like,
That would make a big difference,
Imagine the difference that would make.
And in reality, it might be that many in the end. You know, the ones that are, you know, are truly vacant, and we could get on the rental market or for sale, and that would make a difference. If you think about it, our housing output every year is only 30,000 at the moment. That would make a difference. And then the same thing goes for the dereliction, because the derelict homes wouldn't fall under that tax because they're not habitable. But by bringing them back into use, I think that can make a difference too. And that's one thing, actually, another thing I would like to change about the housing targets is when we talk about that figure of 30,000 last year, that's the target pretty much for this year as well. We don't include in that vacant homes brought back into use, and we don't include student accommodation. And I actually think we should.
Well, on that, it's the student, because where we live, it's surrounded by student accommodation. It's also surrounded by apartments, all built to rent. We know the reasons why, finance and all the rest. But the build-to-rent apartments are extortionately priced. Their rent is huge. But with the rise in interest rates, there is a worry. And again, this is in the Housing Europe report today, that they're predicting the output from the build-to-rent sector to fall quite a lot. And considering our reliance on the private sector to build those apartments, where do you see that going?
Well, I think in certain circumstances, government's going to have to step in, and we're doing that already with the LDA. So let's say, for example, there is a planning permission out there to build apartments, and the developer can't do it, can't get finance from the big funds, you know, where they might have gotten in the past because of the increase in interest rates. Well, then government can step in and we can then use the LDA to finance the building of those apartments. And then we can say that they have to be used for the purposes which we determine. So sometimes that might be social housing, sometimes it might be cost rental, other times it might be affordable purchase. So without getting into too much details, there's Project Tussie and there's the Croí Cónaithe City scheme, and they're the schemes that we use to do that. So it will mean the government stepping in, and we are already doing that, and there'll be some announcements of deals that we've done in the next couple of weeks. And there is a planning clause, which you probably know about it. Local authorities can, when granting planning permission, set the condition that a house or a duplex has to be open, offered for sale. They can't currently do that for apartments. And I think maybe we should change that. You know, we do need build to rent in our cities, but we also need apartments that people can buy.
Yeah.
And local authorities have used that clause with respect to 30,000 permissions. You know, so these are permissions for houses and duplexes. And local authority has said in 30,000 cases, this has to be offered for sale. Can't be offered for rent, at least not initially. That power doesn't exist for apartments. And I think it probably should. And that would give Dublin City Council, for example, you know, the power to say that we are granting permission for this apartment block, but it has to be for sale.
But have the standards not changed for build to rent? So when they're building those apartments, they don't fall under the correct criteria to actually be available for sale. So they have to be for rent, the sizes and balconies and outside space and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I have to check that, because I know Darragh made some changes on the regulations for build to rent. And that does raise the question, you know, should there be different standards at all for build to rent properties over ones that are for purchase?
And if the government are stepping in, is that not just another kind of way of propping up the market? Should there not be a case of, well, I feel anyway, like if you take Cork Street, for example, there's so many derelict sites along there that have been bought and sold over the decades, where a developer goes in, they buy it, they get planning, and then they sell it on and they get that windfall and they make a lot of money for not actually doing anything. Would you look at putting in, say, a land value tax or a site value tax and kind of use it or lose it on that planning, so that they can't do that? They can't just buy a site, get planning, and then sell it on.
Yeah, well, they will be taxed on that. You know, I think anyway, the capital gains tax would apply in that circumstance. And then we do have the, you know, the derelict tax. We have a number of taxes coming in. One that's quite controversial at the moment is that use it or lose it one, where land is owned for residential development. And if you don't develop it, then you end up paying a tax. So that's a new one. It only falls due, I think, from September next year. Now, that is causing some controversy, by the way, because, you know, we farmers around the country who are saying that, you know, this is the land that I farm and maybe it is serviced, but, you know, I want to keep farming it. And they're appealing at the moment. And then even around Dublin City, there are some places that are, they're used for employment purposes now. They're factories or they're commercial. And because they're zoned residential, they're now falling under this tax. And they're saying, well, yes, we can develop this land for housing, but we'd have to close our business and lay off the staff and move out to the edge of the city, which creates its own problems. So we kind of have to get that one right. But that's why that tax is being brought in, to prevent land hoarding, essentially, and flipping, which is happening.
There's a massive reliance on the private sector for this delivery of housing. And I know in Housing for All, you've announced that you're building more social housing ever since the 70s. Which is great. However, that's 50 years ago and we're only building the same now, social housing, as we were 50 years ago. And if we go back to when our houses were built 100 years ago, the first kind of tenant purchase schemes, is there an argument there that we could, you know, the government could go back to that type of home building where the government act as the developer? It's your land. You employ the trades directly to build these houses or apartments or whatever it may be on government land. What is it that's stopping that, what we did 100 years ago when we had no money and now we're rich? What is it that's stopping that from happening? Or is it down to lack of availability in trades? Is it down to that would discourage private developers from building because the government can obviously do it cheaper? What is it that's kind of holding us back there?
I do think we are doing a lot in terms of social housing at the moment. And I know there's this narrative that comes across sometimes that, you know, my party in particular, Fine Gael, is anti-social housing. Like, that's really not the case. You know, there's 40,000 more families in social housing now than was the case 10 years ago. And by social housing, I don't mean HAP. I mean council houses or houses from approved housing bodies. And actually, the percentage of people living in social housing is now 10%. It's too low, but it's actually gone up in the past 10 years. So, you know, there was a freeze on home building when the country was broke, but, you know, we ended that freeze a long time ago, around 2014 or 2015, and we've been building up social housing a lot more since then. We would see the LDA as the government body to do what you're describing.
Yeah.
So, you know, was in Shangana not too long ago. Dundrum would be another place where this new government agency, LDA, is a developer in its own right. And what it's going to do is affordable housing, cost rental and social housing. Now, I know some people say we should go further and we should actually not use subcontractors at all, that we should kind of hire the builders, the plumbers,
yeah,
the electricians, all that directly. I think it'd be interesting to try that, just to try it out and see how it works as a concept. So I'm not entirely opposed to it. But I think what you would probably do is you'd probably just displace other home building. You know, those staff would move from an existing company to the government one.
Would that be such a bad thing, though?
If the result was that you didn't actually increase the number of homes being built and your cost of building was higher than the private sector's, it wouldn't be a great thing.
Well, how would it be higher, though, if you're not paying for the land, if it's on your land, if it's on the government's land?
Oh, well, like if it's on the government's land, you know, we are in some cases developing that ourselves and in other cases doing it in partnership. But generally, when government tends to do things, it does tend to come out more expensive than the private sector for a number of reasons.
Well, yeah,
good ones and bad ones, by the way.
We see that with the children's hospital, and that's always the argument people will make when you talk about the government.
But to be honest, like it's not something that I am vehemently opposed to. Like I wouldn't be against the idea of having one of our local authorities or even the LDA trying that out. I'm just not convinced that it's the silver bullet that some people think it is. Like what I think we need, if we're going to build a number of new homes, we need is everyone doing it. So, you know, the government, the private sector, and then partnerships between the government and the private sector. I don't think if people say that there was an over concentration on the private sector in the past, I don't necessarily think an over concentration on the government doing everything in the future would be the best result either. The government needs to do a lot more housing, and also the private sector needs to do a lot more housing too.
We could look towards other countries, I guess, for a model on that. Like Vienna is always touted as being a great model to follow. Denmark have, or Amsterdam, so Vienna and Amsterdam both have over 40% of their stock is social housing. And the research suggests that actually makes housing more affordable for everybody, not just those in social housing. Would that be a model you would kind of look towards?
Been to Vienna, a lovely city. When you talk to people in Vienna, they talk about the housing crisis too, by the way. And a lot of people in Vienna are leaving the city for the outskirts for lots of different reasons. And Vienna has very low levels of home ownership. You know, that is their model. I don't think it's the model that most Irish people want. I think most Irish people want to own their home, not just in the country, but also in the cities. So that would be my difficulty with that model, because German model, Austrian model, these are countries that have the lowest levels of home ownership are among the lowest levels of home ownership in Europe, whereas I think what Irish people want is to be able to own their own home for lots of different reasons, particularly cultural reasons, but also reasons around housing security.
Definitely, and that's what I see as well. But last year there was more homes built for rent than there were for sale. So that kind of contradicts that, where people do want to own their own home, but if we're not building enough for people to buy.
Yeah, and we need to. But if we went for that Vienna model, we wouldn't be building more homes for people to buy. We'd be building more public housing, essentially. But again, as I said earlier, I don't think it's really about how we divide up the pie, the 30,000 that are being built every year. I think we need to build a lot more. We probably need to be building 40, 50, 60,000 a year. And that means more social housing. It means more cost
more
rental,
of everything.
But particularly, it means more housing for people to buy.
How do we get there then? How do we get to 60,000 instead? How do we double that capacity?
You know, I think we can do it. You know, as I mentioned, 10, 11 years ago when I first got into office was only 7,000 my first term as Taoiseach, it was 20. It's now 30. So even by increasing by 5 or 10,000 a year, I think we can get there. So it's 30,000 is the target for this year. Let's just say it's 35 the year after, 40 the year after that, 45, 50. You know, you're getting 60,000 by the end of the decade. And I think that's doable.
Do you think it's radical enough?
Look, the most important thing for me is that it's enough, that we have enough housing in the country that we're able to bring rents under control, that more people can become homeowners. So if that's the outcome, yes. But, you know, I am very clear, and I've always said this, we can't solve this crisis without additional supply, but it isn't just about supply on its own. We do need to do the other things too. And I do agree with your basic point around social housing. Only about 10% of housing in Ireland now is social housing. That's higher than it was 10 years ago, by the way. But in a lot of countries, it's closer to 20%. And that would be better for everyone, not just the people who benefit from social housing, who get to live in social housing with, you know, affordable rents. But it does actually free up other properties for other people to rent and helps to bring down the cost of housing generally. But getting from where we are now, which I think is about 180,000 social housing homes in Ireland, to where you'd like to be, 360, that is going to take time.
Okay. And I know, speaking of time, I think our time is up. So maybe we can check back in in 6 months or so, or a year.
And, I should say, I did enjoy your book. I picked it up in Marlowe's. and there's a section of it that I am going to follow up, and I am following up with Darragh, which I found very interesting, which is around just the complications of the process of buying a home.
Yeah.
Not sure which ones we can do, which ones we can't, but we're going to get some, we're going to look at a property and see if there are things we can change around that home. I think it's chapter 16, but that kind of home buying process, which I know a lot of people find really frustrating.
Absolutely. I could talk about it all day. So, you know,
it's a long time since I bought a house. So, but I do. I think it's got harder for lots of reasons.
Yeah. If you have my number, you can ring me. I can give you some tips as to what people are finding very, very difficult. It is an arduous process. There's a lot of grey areas in it.
And maybe some unnecessary delays like
probate.
Yeah. Like we have to look at these things because there's always a lot of unintended consequences. But I think one of the suggestions you had was that a house shouldn't be offered for sale until probate's sorted.
Yeah.
And that the seller should do the survey.
Yeah.
And on the face of it, they sound like really good ideas, but we have to get our officials to look at it so they can tell us why it's not, and then we'll decide whether or not they're right or wrong.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Emil.
Now, I hope you found our conversation with Taoiseach Leo Varadkar helpful. I hope you found it insightful and constructive. If you're listening to this thinking you're pulling your hair out because he wouldn't answer questions, I understand that. Please do remember, I'm a complete rookie. I'm a complete amateur. It's very, very difficult to respond in real time with facts and figures. I do my best to do that. I believe that it's far more beneficial to have these conversations and try and talk to leaders about it rather than just complain about it online. So please do remember that when you're commenting on my Instagram or doing whatever or getting in touch. I'm not Vincent Brown. I did what I could. I did my best. And look, let's hope something good comes out of it. I understand there are no easy answers, but it's through these kind of dialogues that we can hope to try and create change. And remember, everyone has a role to play in making home ownership more accessible and affordable. Don't just leave it up to everyone else. Don't just leave it up to me or other people or just have a moan online. Engage with your local TDs and politicians. Take notes when you're consuming content like this or other content and come up with your own questions for when politicians do come knocking on your doors, which they will again very soon. And instead of just screaming and shouting online, maybe come up with some constructive questions and just engage in dialogue and less abuse and more just conversation, more talking. That's how we get things done. So I'd like to thank Taoiseach Leo Varadkar for coming on the podcast and engaging in conversation and for some of his positive feedback on the solutions I proposed in my book, which is called How to Buy a Home in Ireland, if anybody wants to check it out. So hopefully we can make some headway on some things, just even if we can just improve the process a little bit, I'd be happy with that. And that's about as much as I can hope for, I think, at this point. I'd love 70,000, 80,000 homes to be built, but if you've got got thoughts or questions on what we've discussed, do get in touch. But please don't be getting in touch with me saying just giving out because I've no interest. I did my best. Or if there's someone you'd like to hear from on the podcast, please do let me know who you'd like me to chat to on here. And if you want to continue supporting these conversations, please do consider becoming a patron. As I said, you get access to exclusive content, including Q&A podcasts that you won't find anywhere else. So just go to patreon.com/crazyhouseprices. So thanks for listening and for being part of this conversation and for doing your part to help this crazy house prices community keep growing. Slán go fóill.